At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
What's happening, everybody? This is Tyre Wilson with another episode of Elevate Your Game. Today, we have head coach of Milken Community School. Okay, I was right. Milken Community School, the director of HBT. That means hard work beats talent. Mr. Thomas Blunt. How you doing, sir?
What's up, T?
Thank you for coming to the show, my brother. Here at Elevate Your Game, we just try to inspire the community, give back to the basketball culture, talking through our experiences, and give advice to the coaches, parents, players, or whoever it is that's seeking advice. So I know we're going to learn from your amazing experience as a player, coach, and dad now, and, you know, business owner. And so thanks for coming to the show, brother.
My pleasure.
We love to start it off with the Wall of Hoop movies. Your favorite movie and why?
Oh, man, this is a tough one, but I got to go with Blue Chips. I got to go with Blue Chips. Definitely was a fan of Anthony Hardaway. I think he was one of my, you know, Magic being my favorite player of all times. And then finding a new player after Magic retired, Penny was definitely a fan of Penny and Shaq. So to see them on a big screen, and I feel like that was the first movie that really showed you what goes on with high school athletes being, you know, recruited and pampered on their way to college.
So. Absolutely. So what are you asking for if you was in that movie? What are you taking to get you to go?
Look.
You want a tractor? What you trying to get?
Oh, man, I probably would have had to go with the house for my parents and a nice car for me.
There we go.
Yeah.
Hey, the house and the whip. That's the Penny Hardaway package, right? That's the Penny Hardaway package. No, it's dope, man. I think that movie exposed a little bit about the basketball culture that not everybody knew about at the time, but, you know, other people did. And now that we have NIL, it's all for free. Like, that movie was, it don't even matter anymore. So they can actually get you those things. So it's crazy how the world turns and how basketball changes. So,
yeah.
Absolutely. So, first question. Well, I guess second question now. First question about you specifically. When did you fall in love with basketball?
I want to say like 5, 6. I found myself just at the park, watching guys, you know, play at the park, and of course they wouldn't let me on, but I would just dribble the whole time and watch them and just dribble around, and that's really where I fell in love with it. And then, you know, being from LA and watching the Lakers and being a big fan of Magic. Magic just made basketball seem so happy.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Now, he always did play with a smile. That's I didn't even realize that.
Yeah.
No, he does make it exciting and fun to watch. And he played an exciting brand of basketball. So you came up during the Showtime Lakers period. I don't know if any of you guys seen Thomas Hoop, but he tries to be like Magic, but he just doesn't do the passing part. He just shoots. But he definitely is smiling while he's doing it. So it's a lot of fun, man. He's a bucket. So grew up in L.A. What was your experience like growing up in L.A. during the Showtime Lakers and you know, coming up? And you went to Palisades High, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, what was that experience like?
Growing up, I grew up in South Central, so there was a lot of extracurricular activities going on that basketball just kind of took me away from and just gave me something to like really look forward to. So I slept with a basketball. I kept a basketball in my hand. If you ever seen me, saw me walking down the street with the basketball, and you know,
there you go, man.
Maybe just kept me out of, you know, yeah. I got to wear what I wanted to wear because I had this in my hand, didn't have to necessarily worry about, you know.
So, yeah, so was there a pass? You know, these are things that we could talk about on this show because I think it's important, especially in landscaping LA basketball, is being an athlete in LA, gangs and things like that gave you a pass sometimes. So, what was that like and how? You know, how did you even understand that at an early age?
Well, it gave me a pass in my neighborhood. Gotcha. Not in anybody else's.
Okay.
But just, you know, being able to, you know, I have family members who were in that line and, you know, went forward to do that. But at the same time, they made sure that I did not. So when they saw that I had something that I enjoyed, they pushed it on me and made sure I kept that in hand. But yeah, just being able to navigate and knowing where you're going in LA is a big deal. But sports definitely, you know, whether you were a gang member or not, you know, you still have a sense of, you still feel a sense of responsibility for your community. And, you know, when you see some of the youth that are, you know, going one way rather than the other, you know, they tend to give you a pass. So I definitely had a pass, but I also had a brother.
Ah.
So, yeah, he helped with that pass. So,
yeah. Awesome. And so when coming up, was AAU big? Did you play AAU basketball yourself, or when did it get serious as far as the competition in basketball?
I think I started to play in my first league at 11 years old. And from then on, like 12, I played AAU. I don't necessarily remember AAU being as serious for me, but just a means of being able to play organized,
yeah.
Right? So I think I floated between a couple of teams, Santa Monica Cougars and Westside Blazers. So I would, you know, you kind of tend to go where your friends are.
Yeah.
But nowadays, it's intense. You know, it's super intense. Playing AAU basketball back then, you were getting yelled at a lot. Not necessarily understanding what you're being screamed at for.
Right.
So, you know, as a coach today, I kind of take those, things and remember, you know, what's going to reach the kid and what's not going to reach the kid. So,
yeah.
You know, yelling doesn't necessarily equate to them understanding. You know, for example, like, you know, a kid makes a mistake, you yell at them, you put everybody on the line.
Yeah.
And once they get on the line, you know, are they taking advantage of, hey, this is getting me in more shape?
Right.
Or are they spending the time running mad at you? Because mm-hmm. I think we all got yelled at in our household. So when another person yelled at us, it was like in our head, we cussing you out.
Right.
You know, so just being able to, you know, get on a kid today and put them on the line, but get them in the right mindset for, you know, for them to take full advantage of, you know, of the running and understanding their mistakes.
No, that's a good point. I never really thought of it from that take. I just say, hey, it was just a little tougher for us growing up. We got yelled at, everybody yelled at us, but it's because we got yelled at home as well. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a concept of gentle parenting, which wasn't around, I don't say especially for the Black community, it was no gentle parenting because they were preparing us for something bigger than just our childhood, I think, and the toughness that we may have dealt with growing up. But that is a interesting concept. And I seen that like, hey, when I talk to certain kids this way, they fold.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't compare it to, you know, hey, I'm used to it happening at home. So when a coach yells at me, it means, man, one of my coaches had the worst breath. And so I make sure I always have gum. That's another thing. Make sure y'all have gum when you talk to these kids. But that was the difference with his yelling. Like, I didn't like getting yelled at behind him because it was halitosis happening.
It was
so,
hot.
It was hot, bro. So. So, yeah, so that's dope. So when did you notice that you were good at basketball?
I always felt like I was good. You know, it was I played so much, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Even, you know, just thinking back being in elementary school and, you know, you would go and check out a piece of equipment to go and play with it. I was always checking out a basketball and going by myself and form shooting and working on things that I saw on TV. There was no trainers.
How did you develop? Is that, did you have somebody showing you how to form shoot, or where did that come from?
Never. It just literally came from me watching the game, going outside, trying to emulate, you know, whose shot looks nice, and just being like a student and watching the game and, you know, take a crossover move, I'm going outside, I'm doing that.
Yeah.
You know, I see someone who's a good shooter, you know, I'm keyed in and watching their shooting form or different things like that. And I would take that and go outside and work on it a lot.
That comes up a lot on this show, all the coaches and players that we speak with, is that emulation, right? You don't see that now. They do, but they're emulating the wrong parts of the game almost. They're doing the super advanced footwork moves that isn't translatable to the fundamentals of the game. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I like to encourage kids to do that. Hey, watch some film and do the good, the fundamental part the right way. So I think that needs to be kind of put back into the culture. And just little games like to explore your creativity with the game. So I had kids playing 21 the other day. One of them literally did not know how to play 21.
Not 3-2-1, it's playing 3-2-1, huh?
What is that?
3-2-1 is it's like the ball, you know, as soon as you get the ball,
you have three seconds
oh, to shoot it. Gracious. So, I mean, it's every time I see kids playing that game, I'm like, nope. Either stop that game or you guys get out. Get out the gym.
No, 20, our old school 21, checkup, free throws. Anybody could guard you.
You could get doubled. Somebody is, if you go to the basket and you like and you don't step up and help, you're like, yo, like, block that. What are you doing?
No, I think that, man, I'm bringing that all the way back just with the development, with the training, so kids can have some freedom and creativity. We're doing so much structural training. We're teaching them, and it's great for technique and skill, but they're losing their creativity and their confidence of who they are, how they feel and move and stuff like that. So trying to add that stuff back in, but it all is connected to that emulation of the other players that we used to look up to growing up. So
everybody thinks they can dribble 15, 20 times to get a move off. Yeah. We grew up, you get two dribbles.
Yep. Easy.
Two dribbles to get, and that's how we play one on one. We play two dribble one on one.
Yep.
Can't get the basket in that.
It's a wrap.
It's a wrap.
Absolutely. So, high school experience. So, did you start at Palisades, finished at Palisades? What was your high school journey like?
I actually, my 10th grade, I graduated middle school, 9th grade. I think that was like the last year before it turned to you go from 8th grade to high school in 9th grade.
Oh, so you went from 9th and then went to that?
9th. It was my last year of junior high, middle school. And then my dad moved to Minneapolis. So I spent my sophomore year in Minneapolis and then came back to Palisades and, went through some different things there. Loved it because that's where all my friends were. But basketball-wise, it wasn't the best place to be. So senior year, I ended up leaving and moving with my mom out to Rosemead High School, and I finished there. I didn't play. Okay. I finished there. I just really just worked out, changed my body, grew 4 inches, grew 4 to 5 inches.
So you didn't play your senior year? That's crazy.
I didn't play my senior year.
Wow. And grew, and that's when you had your growth spurt.
When I had my growth spurt.
When everybody has that like moment of, I'm a hooper now, like I'm a real hooper, and your body catches up.
Yeah.
All right, and so what happened after high school? Then you graduated?
I graduated. I was supposed to go to Grambling, which that's where my dad's alumni from. So I went back to Minnesota, and he was going to take me down to school. But my year of being in high school, I still had some friends there. And one of my friends was playing at Minneapolis Community College. And I wasn't necessarily keen on going to school in Louisiana, but I knew I had to get out of my mom's house, basically. So I ended up going there and was speaking with the coaches and ended up staying there. I think I was 6'5 then. So I went from 6 feet to 6'5. So I was played every position in junior college and stayed there for those 2 years.
Okay. And then after that, let me ask this. With junior college, what was junior college like? Talk about that experience. I don't think enough kids, first off, kids think junior college is like you failed in life, and that's not necessarily the case at all, right?
No, not at all.
Because, we're going to fast forward through your story a little bit. You end up playing pro for 8 years and making money playing basketball. So, obviously, things worked out for you, and you didn't play. You moved, it seemed like, every year in high school, didn't play your senior year, ended up in junior college, and still had success through basketball. So, that's, kudos to you for that. In junior college, what was that experience like, especially in the Midwest? Is that something that you should, would you tell a kid, refer them to do?
I would definitely, especially coming from the West Coast here, I think when you start to move east a little bit, it starts to, junior college starts to feel more like you are actually at a four-year.
Yeah.
You're away from home, you're a away from doing things. And it was one of the best 2 years I've ever had basketball wise. And I don't mean just through success, but through the friendships I made. Our starting five, we were so close. I think in 2 years we lost 4 games.
Dang.
So we had a really good team, really close knit.
So y'all made it to Hutch? Y'all made it to the Nationals and all that?
Or? We lost in our state, in the state finals to get there.
Okay, gotcha.
So yeah, I was in foul trouble. And,
well, you knew.
That still haunts me to this day.
So junior college, who do you remember, so as far as development goes, things that you teach, or are there things that you learned in junior college that you still teach to this day?
To even get a uniform and get on the team, we would have to do what we call 10 and 30. So it's 10 suicides. You have to make each one of them in 30 seconds. Mm. So you run a suicide, you have to make it in 30. Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm sorry, it was 10 and 30 Tuesday. I shaved 2 seconds
off. Yeah, I was saying, hold up.
I shaved 2 seconds off when I started coaching. It's 10 and 30s now, but you know, you have to make that suicide in 32 seconds, then you get 32 second rest while the other group goes. Mm-hmm. And you can even make the team without making those.
Yeah.
So my first year doing that, took me like...
Today, that's called corporal punishment. You cannot do that to kids.
You cannot do that to kids.
They're allergic to suicide. Like, I don't even think you could use that name anymore.
I'm trying to figure out a new name for that. Let me know if you find one.
Wow, man. At Heritage, we did not call them suicides. We called them something else. Man, we called them something else.
I cringe every time I
Yeah, because it's different. It has a different, definite, different meaning now. I forgot what we call them, so we call them something else though. And yeah, I'm a coach in years, so
I'm gonna have to think of another name.
Yeah,
as well,
so. Yeah, runners or something like that. It was something like that. But okay, so yeah, so some conditioning. Yeah, junior college conditioning is even different than like 4-year university conditioning. Mm-hmm. It is. I remember Hell Week for us in junior college was just wake up at 5 a.m. Wake up at 5 a.m. We had to run 3 miles. Plus, we're doing our speed and agility, plus we had a full practice, plus we had cardio after, like, man, it was serious. And then class, yes, you had to do that as well. But I was in the best shape of my life. Yeah. Man, I looked like a G.I. Joe, and I was windmilling like crazy. So it was definite payoff to all that, man. I miss them days almost. I ain't going back. All right, so from junior college, so what happened after that? How is the recruitment going and your opportunities after junior college?
I don't know if you want to get into all that, Todd, but...
We got to. We got to let them know.
My recruiting was a little different. I played for a coach who was... we're very good standings now, but back then, I felt like he had something against me. Mm. And... So as far as recruiting goes, I end up going where I felt, where I thought I would feel comfortable rather than where I should have went.
Mm. Well, I have to go back, and you guys are cool now because this is the part of the show where I think people need to hear, because I think there's a lot of kids in this situation. Why did you feel like the coach did not like you? What was it exactly? And now, you know, hindsight, what do you see that situation really being?
I feel like, you know, a lot of college coaches have a certain way with certain kids who come in with a certain type of confidence. Mm-hmm. And I think my coach wanted to break my confidence down and spoon feed it to me. And I had a problem with that. You know, I had my dad in my life. He's already done that to me. He's already done that for me.
Yeah.
So to try to break that down at that point, being a 19-year-old, just wasn't necessarily working for me. I was never a disrespectful kid. I wasn't raised that way. But I knew when I was being unfairly treated. And so in some instances when things, you know, just got a bit too much, it was hard to hold my tongue. Mm-hmm. And like I say, not hold my tongue and like I wasn't cussing my coach out or nothing like that, but you know, I would have a question, you know, if you're gonna treat me. There's one practice in particular I remember And I played five positions in junior college because I was, you know, just last year I was point guard my whole life, and you know, now I'm tall, so I had the freedom to play those five positions and push the ball and do those things. And I remember we were in practice one day, and we were scrimmaging. Now this is, you know, we went at each other every day, which this is the fun part of practice. Well, our two guard never had to come in defensive rebound. He just, you know, our two guard took off to the corner. So he put the two guard, and I took the ball out. He put the two guard, changed him, and put him at the one, but he kept forgetting and taking off down the court. I calmly said to Malcolm, "Mal, you got to remember you the one. Come back. It's my boy." Like, I didn't get into him or nothing. Well, next play down, coach stops it, and he's like, "You know what? I would have kicked your ass when I was your age." And I'm like, my teammates are walking past me, like, because at this point, they're like, "Thomas, just..." They're walking past me like, don't say nothing. Say, "No, I'm about to get kicked out of practice." And I'm like, and my response was, "You don't look that old to me, coach."
Trying to catch the man.
Get out, Thomas. So, you know, so feeling that, you know, I felt like things were more personal and not about basketball. And I went on to different colleges and experienced the same type of things. But for me, I just looked at them as, I looked at them as obstacles. You know, I faced the same type of obstacles in high school. I went on to college to face the same type of obstacles, but I was determined to not let that stop me. I knew what I wanted to do. I knew where I wanted to be. And, you know, I wasn't going to let anybody stop me from doing that.
So, always a conflict is two-sided, right? You know this now that you're in marriage, right? There's always two sides to a story. So let's talk about the other side. I always think when somebody goes through a same obstacle over and over and over, did you handle it differently as you seen it at the next level when you came up to a coach that, you know, would challenge you in that way, you know, that maybe took it too personal? Did you see it as something that you can manage in yourself or something that you needed to, you know, learn or grow from?
I tried to do more of communicating with the coaches, trying to get them to see me for who I was, not from where I come from. I think a lot of the slack came from where, you know, Los Angeles, and, you know, everybody thinks Los Angeles is all, you know, sunshine and women.
Right.
The Hollywood sign of everything. So I think that can sometimes, you know, give a person a different type of perception from you, not understanding that where you are right now, you've struggled to get there.
Yep.
You know? Yeah. So my approach was just trying to be, just trying to communicate. And as I got older, I learned that, you know, college coaches kind of treat you a certain way because their job's on the line. And, you know, some coaches are able to see past that job and see you as an individual. And some have a problem, you know, have struggle with doing that.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, you know, that's what you really have to look at, in my opinion, when you're going to play for these different colleges.
Yeah.
It's more about what they show you than what they're telling you. Because, you know, they'll sell you the moon. And, you know, for example, when I end up going to, I chose this Division II school, Wichita Baptist in Arkansas. And at that point, I wanted to play one position. I wanted to focus on playing one position. So I wanted to play the three. And so when I was, you know, I went on this visit, and, you know, one mistake I did make was not going on all my visits. You know, I'm like, I'm about to, you know, they'll find you anywhere. Right? So... you know, I spoke with the coach and just had, you know, a good conversation with him and told him, you know, I'm a three. This is a position I want to play, you know. And he told me everything I wanted to hear, everything. So, okay, I like the, you know, that's where I joined frat. They were big on my recruiting visit, and I loved them. I really enjoyed that. So, you know, they played a big part of me choosing to go there. And first day, official practice, Midnight Madness. And we had my teammate, Corey Barber, may he rest in peace. He's a four. He's a legit four.
Okay.
And so when you separate the teams, he's like, Thomas, you're at the four. Corey, you're at the three. And I'm in my head, I'm like, he's just messing. He's got to be just messing with me. And Corey looks at me and he's like, T, like, I'm a four. You play the three. Not my doing. I That's said nothing. That's what he said. So I'm like, all right, first play. He sees me at the three, timeout, cusses me out. Literally just cusses me out. And I was like, oh, man.
Dang.
I'm back in the fire. Back in the fire.
What is that? That I think there's two things to it, right? That one, coach wants to get talent, right? Mm-hmm. They want to just gain as much talent, tell you what you want to hear. Some of those promises are real. Some of them are just empty promises. And maybe the idea was, hey, they're going to get somebody who could play the four so they could push you to the three. Whatever. It could be some type of excuse. Mm-hmm. But also there's this pride factor that you see in a lot of college coaches, especially on the lower level, I believe. And this is not all of them. This mm-hmm. is with experiences that I've had myself, is that they do, I think, I want to say this the right way, but I'm being very transparent about it, is that I think a junior college and lower level colleges, they get a certain level of kid. This is more back in the day than it is now, but it could happen today, is that they get a certain type of kid from a certain neighborhood mm-hmm. that needs certain securities around them because mm-hmm. they grew up in a vulnerable or insecure environment. And so they coach focused and based around that. And so if you have a two-parent household and you have some moral standards, values that allow you to kind of be your own person, mm-hmm. they don't know how to coach that
yes.
because they're so used to coaching this person who, hey, I'm a father figure to this person now. Mm-hmm. Like, nah, bro, you ain't my daddy. Yeah. So you're a coach. I respect you and I honor that. And you're a part of my journey. And I think they take offense to this guy doesn't need me. And they're in this power struggle of being this head coach to this sport.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when sometimes they don't look like you. Right. They have this dominance
mm-hmm.
that they want to put over you. And so I think like what you're saying is important for them to know for when you're getting recruited. I tell them all the time, go ask the kids what their experience is like. Don't let the coach tell you what he wants to. Kids, go ask the kids, hey, what's your experience like? Mm-hmm. Is he a transactional coach or a relational coach? That's mm-hmm. the difference in what we're talking about. Transactional is like, hey, you get buckets, you play.
Yeah.
You know, that type of thing.
When don't ask the starters.
Yeah, because they get all the, exactly. Ask
don't
the dude
ask
at
the
end bench. Ask the dude who just transferred out. Hey, why'd you leave?
Because mm-hmm.
you can see that. That's all on the internet now. And parents, talk to the kids' parents. Ask for those, hey, do you have so-and-so's family number? I just want to hear what their experience is like. Because the parents are going to know and they're going to see. And that relational part of a coach getting to know a kid and to really develop them as an individual.
Right.
Now, I'm more, if you're gonna invest into me as an individual, I'm okay not getting playing time. Cause I see you still trying to push me mm-hmm. and make me, you know, that my assistant coaches were always like that in junior college. We're like, oh, we're invested into Todd. Like, hey, do this, help you out. My head coach was just like, yo, your job is to set screens and play defense. Straight up. And he was like, hey, and we're cool now. And he was like, he came in the beginning of my sophomore year. Hey, so college, what are you looking at? Well, man, I'm hoping for a Division I opportunity mm-hmm. coming here, you know, at the least Division II.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, ah, Todd, I see you more of a D3 and AI guy. And I'm like, so I got here and got worse? Like, I was getting recruited by Division II before I got here. Why all of a sudden am I a lower level? Well, Todd, are you putting in extra work? Me? Do I put in there? I said, go ask all my teammates who comes in and rebounds and mm-hmm. shoots with them every time they give a call.
Mm-hmm.
Go see who's in the weight room more than anybody. I said, I'm your most coachable kid. I win every cardio drill. What are we talking about?
Mm-hmm.
I'm the hardest worker, one of the hardest workers you got.
He knows that.
But man, I don't think he did. Or he was blind to it, but I think it was part of, he was literally almost everyone else on the team who got playing time came from a different situation. And this was their way out of that situation, mm-hmm. was playing basketball. And so they, you know, there was things that I didn't understand. I definitely matured after leaving there and understanding the whole game. But it was still like, man, I was still good enough. All you had to do was put a little confidence in me. Let me rock out a little mm-hmm. bit, and I could have, you know, done something with it. Yeah. I'm the one who went the furthest probably with basketball of all them dudes in junior college. Mm-hmm. Still, or say, still connected to the game this close, and it pays for my life what mm-hmm. I do with hoop. And it was just like, man, why don't you see this? Why don't you see this in me? But I never want to give power to the person who's trying to take it away from mm-hmm. me. And so, hey, that's on me. I'm going to just make sure the next kid knows.
Yeah. But what I can say about all that is it made me tougher. It made me determined. It made me see that I can be who I say I'm going to be. And, you know, someone else's perception of you should not deter you from doing the things that you feel that you want to be able to do. Okay. So, you know, I can say all these things about my past coaches, and but at the same time, they made me stronger by all the BS they, you know what I'm saying, that they, you know, kind of put me through. And, you know, I was like, I'll never be a coach.
Look at you now.
Like, literally.
Well, no, you know what kind of coach you didn't want to be, right? And, you know, I coached right beside you, and man, you put confidence in all them kids, man. So the ones who shouldn't even been touching the basketball, you even put confidence in them. And so you did the opposite of what your coaches did in those situations. Moving forward, so did you stay at that school and play the four, or what happened after
I left that school. And after that school, I had had 1 year left.
Yep.
And I was like, I don't want to play college basketball anymore. Mm. I'm done with college coaches. So I just started working out and came back to LA. I hadn't been home in 3 years. And just start, you know, I was playing at the Drew, and just, you know, working my way into going to some different workouts. So at that point, I thought my end would be going play overseas and working out to being able to do those things. And through that process, prayer, man, I had some people being like, you know, you have to make a decision. Are you going to finish this year of college? Or are you going to, you know, pursue this? Because if you pursue this, then you lose that. You're going to lose that year of eligibility. And I prayed about it, man. And I would always go back to Minneapolis to see some of my friends and my teammates. And happened to be hanging out with my teammates and an assistant coach at Concordia University. And they had just, they were spending their last year of moving into Division II. So they were in a probationary period. And it looked like a good fit for me. I was familiar with Minnesota. And it was important for me to complete college. Because I know once I leave, the chances of me coming back may be slim. Because part of my motivation of, you know, getting my coursework and my stuff done was basketball.
Right.
So I wanted to keep that mm-hmm. motivation rather than I'm working this regular job and trying to go to school. Like,
right.
You know, that's probably be a little bit tougher. So, and I'm going back to Concordia and going through the same thing.
Oh, again.
Going through something similar again. But in this situation, the coach had been there. This was his first year of being eligible in the tournament or in NCAA Division II. And I think he started feeling pressure of we wasn't winning. Mm-hmm. So he created a storm and put it on me and suspended me for a couple of games after I just had two great games. So that was another piece of adversity that I had to work through. But instead of getting angry, being upset, I just start killing him with kindness. Like, every day he'd see me, I walk past his office, I'd be like, hey, coach, I'll come and tell him whatever I need to do to get my starting spot back. I mean, I'm getting double teamed, Todd. I'm the only one on the team getting double teamed every
buckets,
touch.
Right?
Every touch. You know what I mean? And I'm not starting. Like, that's
right.
That's unheard of. Other team is like, man, you're all over our scouting report. How are you coming off the, you know, all of a sudden you're coming off the bench last 8 games of my last season.
Dang. What was the suspension for?
He said my teammates don't like me.
Oh, like you didn't even do anything?
No. His reasoning was my teammates don't like me. And so when I come into the cafeteria to eat and all my teammates are sitting together, I'm like, and I had redshirted. So I was there 2 years. So I redshirted to just get prepared
right.
and be ready and make sure I was, you know, up to all my classes and stuff. And I played the second year. So everyone knew me. I was a little older than my teammates. So I'm the one who they came to for advice.
Right.
I'm the one who stuck up for them. And I was also the one for him being the liaison to go and talk to the teammates. And I was the captain. So you just told the captain that. His teammates. That was the reasoning for it. So that part hurt my feelings. I could deal with the other part, but the part you telling me my teammates don't like me, that part hurt my feelings. So I remember I was just, you know, I see them in the cafeteria, I go sit somewhere else. And they literally got up and came and sat like, what happened? Like, what's wrong? They wanted to know what happened. Like, why are you, why? First he told me I was off the team and that he would reevaluate.
And there was no
when they came back
there was
from
no
the game.
Moment that made that is crazy.
No, I when I went into his office, he wanted to meet with me. I was thinking that he needed me to talk to one of my teammates. And I had a moment sitting there, Todd. I'm not gonna lie, when he said that, like I had like a like I picked the chair up and I threw it out the window.
Yeah.
And with my eyes back, I was still sitting in the same place.
Yeah, that's so Raven moment, look, the future.
Yeah, the future. I was holding, I was grasping the bottom of my seat, like, just sit down. And so that was tough. But what he did get from me and what he saw from me was I just stayed respectful.
Yeah.
And every time he would see me, he saw me every day in the gym, 3 times a day.
Mm.
Every day, because in our arenas, the sports offices were up top. So every time he walked past, I was in the gym. I literally had people who were working there who would call me and be like, we left the back door open for you. That's how much I was in the gym. And so I remember during the spring, he came, he walked down, and he gave me a number to an agent. And that agent ended up getting me my first job. So I think
you kill your enemies with kindness. And he was trying to take something away from you, but he saw your work, your ethic, prayer. And that's the person who opened the door for an opportunity for you to make money playing basketball.
Yep.
That's so dope. So where'd you end up your first year?
Switzerland.
Oh, man, you started off nice. Kind of
I
nice.
Did. I did. But, man, being that first night was hard.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I had a moment. I had to get back in, you know, I had a moment because it was like I found out me and my friends were going out to a club. We were going to party. And my agent calls me right before I'm walking in, so it's probably like midnight.
Hmm.
He's like, I got a contract for you in Switzerland. You know, overseas, you get a call you don't have I don't have the opportunity to go and think about it. It's my first job. I gotta go.
Yep.
So I left the next day.
Dang.
The very next day. So it literally felt like I closed my eyes and I opened my eyes and I was in this. When I first got there, they had me in a hotel room, and I'm used to seeing big room hotels room, but this was a small
like this
maybe a little bit bigger, but like this. And so my first time just being gone away that far away, not knowing anybody, not knowing the language.
Yeah,
I can't watch TV, and so you know you get that jet lag. So I'm sleeping, I fall asleep, and I get to a point where I can't sleep anymore.
Mm.
So I wake up and I'm like, walls are starting to like come in on me.
Man.
And I'm like, I'm getting a serious anxiety attack right now. And I open up the drawer next to me, and there was a Bible in there.
Mm.
And I pulled the Bible out. And
in English?
In English. Mm. The Bible was in English. And probably, I want to say the first place I turned calmed me down. I don't have that scripture in my head right now, but I have it written down.
Mm-hmm.
And it brought me back to, like, yo. Like,
you're going
to
be all right.
You're going to be all right. You are very blessed to be in this situation. And this is what you asked for.
Yeah.
This is what you've been working for. This is what, all the obstacles and the different things that you've had to get through. and now you're here. So shut up.
Shut up and hoop.
Shut up and hoop and go back to sleep. And from that moment forward, I never had any issues with being gone.
That's dope. And then, so how long did you go to a different team every year you played overseas, or what was that journey like?
I went to a different team every year because I was trying to get back here to play.
Got it.
I mean, in all honesty, if I had it over again, I would have went back to some of those countries that I left.
List, what all countries did you play in?
I played in Switzerland, Portugal, China, Belarus, Germany. Am I missing anywhere? That's it.
All right, so what was your favorite place to play in?
My favorite place to play or my favorite place to be? My favorite place.
Let's throw basketball first. We can talk about that too. What is your favorite place to hoop in for basketball purposes?
I enjoy Portugal.
Okay.
I enjoy Portugal. I was there for a good amount of time and then I got hurt. I was like centimeters away from cutting my tendon where my hand would have been like this forever.
Hooping?
After hooping.
Oh boy.
Yeah, I had a little moment. It was an accident.
Oh, okay.
But
okay.
I was still, we was playing a rival game and fans were really hostile and we lost at the last buzzer. And I was also dealing with the death of my grandmother.
Gotcha.
So my emotions were all over. So I just remember thinking before walking in the locker room, like, I don't know what's gonna calm me down. Mm. And so the doors, my teammates are walking in and the door swings back. And I just want to hit the door back, pop the door back open. Well, I didn't know that there was a glass. So, you know, hand went through the glass, you know, surprise. So your first instinct is to do what?
Pull back.
Pull your hand back. And yeah, I'm walking in the locker room leaking, but still can't even, this still isn't.
You don't feel
it? Nah, this still can't like even like calm me down because I'm dealing with death. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't so bad. I don't even think it was that. It was the fact that, you know, I lost somebody very dear to me and I lost them while I was overseas.
Right.
Mm, so that's tough. I remember my teammate. And I had grabbed a towel and I put it over so no one saw it. And I'm walking back and my teammate, Kim Adams, shout out to Kim. He's like, T, let me see it. And I showed it to him and then I walked back the other way and when I turned around, he was in the mirror like this. My goodness.
Hey, I promise
I'll never forget that.
I tell kids all the time, so my senior year in high school, in a game, bad foul called, and you know, the pads are on the wall. I just, boom, socked the wall. Broke my hand. I played with my hand swollen the rest of that game.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell kids all the time, you see with Jaden McDaniels this year, same thing, Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
Hit something because he's upset, breaks his hand. I tell them, when they're in workouts and stuff, they always hitting that wall, stop reacting.
Yes.
Stop getting your anger out that way. Do it on the court in a positive, productive mm-hmm. way, man, because you hurt yourself.
Well, you really have to, you know, control your emotions. And like I said, there was a moment when I was like, I don't know how I'm going to calm down.
Yeah.
And, you know, that didn't calm me down, but definitely was so blessed that I didn't, you know, I could have been done. You know,
that's
just,
crazy.
You know, at the blink of an eye of something that was, an accident. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like I was going to go in the locker room and start throwing things around. I wasn't. It was like I was going to hit the door back open, which was just a reaction because it was coming back at me. Instead of pushing it up, I was hit the door. But, you know, that's how quickly things can, you know, escalate when you're not in control of your emotions. Yeah. So that definitely probably taught me for something that was going to happen bigger to be able to control my emotions. So.
Right. What is, all right, so your favorite place to be?
I enjoyed Switzerland.
Yeah.
I enjoyed Switzerland. I enjoyed the people there. I enjoyed my teammates. I enjoyed just the social aspect of being there. And, you know, Switzerland is kind of like it's like a melting pot, kind of like Los Angeles.
Yeah, so like very little crime.
Yeah.
Very high academics.
Like there's no homeless.
Yeah, it's like
in Switzerland.
Yeah, like they, you know, yeah, I've been reading about it. I like their academic system, how they have a set of people for the youth. So that made sense. That's somewhere I want to visit and somewhere I've considered. I'm like, man, if I ever got to get out the U.S. and go coach somewhere, I'm probably going to Switzerland. It's like, yeah. I'm going to try to go make it work out there.
Beautiful place.
Yeah, beautiful. No, that's dope. All right, so transitioning from your overseas career to coaching, right? So your first coaching job was at Alemany, but you were still in between being overseas.
I was still in between figuring out if I was going to continue to play or not. I was having some issues with my hip. You know, fast forwarding, I have had hip replacement at 37.
Yeah.
But I was having some issues with my hip, so I was kind of in limbo to knowing if I'm going to go back overseas and play. I still had my name in the hat, but I hadn't picked up a contract yet by the time school started. So a friend that I was training, their kids, and they're like, you should go, and there's an opening for an assistant coach at Alemany. And I looked into it, met with Trey, and Trey is a great guy. I attribute a lot. I mean, I got baptized, because of him and seeing how he was moving and how his walk of faith was. Although, you know, I've always been moving faithfully, but I've never been baptized. Mm. So that kind of that experience alone was great. And right after I got baptized, I got a call to leave.
Hmm.
Like literally right after.
What was that last job at?
A couple of days. So that last job was in Belarus, in Minsk.
Okay, gotcha.
Like Russia area out there. And so I coached with Trey for about 2 months before I left. And but what that gave me was an insight of what my next career could be.
Yeah.
I've always enjoyed working with kids. Up to that point, I was already doing training. I had a club team that I was doing with kids, and so I knew that was something that once I got there, I was like, yeah, this is something I definitely want to pursue when I'm done. So I went, finished my last season. Was thinking about playing one more year. I was going to go to Japan. But last minute, that contract fell through, and I was like, I'm done. I want to go ahead and move forward with what I'm doing. And that season, I started as a JV coach at, got a call out of the blue about JV coach at Campbell Hall.
Yeah.
And that kind of just springboarded me into teaching being a full-time coach.
Awesome. So you were JV coach at Campbell Hall for 1 year, and then became
two years,
and then became the varsity coach over there.
I was the coach for 2 years, and then I was doing like personal training and stuff over in Santa Monica at Memorial.
Okay.
And a guy I know, his name's Lucky. He had the he had just became an athletic director over at New Roads.
Gotcha.
And so he would see me in there every day. I've known Lucky. We've known each other. And he was like, man, I just got this job over here. I don't know if I'm necessarily seeing eye to eye with the head coach there. Mind you, I hadn't been a head varsity coach yet. But I would love to get you in some, you know, type of capacity. I know you're doing well and doing your thing over where you are at Campbell Hall. So maybe we can work something out where you can do both. And you know, I love when people do what they say they're gonna do, right? So first off, he got me a PE job at the school, which was great and needed during that time. And then probably in December, he's waiting at my class, and I would walk the same way on campus every day. I'm like, why is he? He's like, I'm walking down the students. He's waiting for me to come. He walks. We go to walk to the park with the class. So he walks to class with me, and he had let his varsity coach go. And he's basically spending his time trying to convince me to take that job. Well, I've always felt a certain connection with the kids at Campbell Hall. And so I, you know, usually when you get an opportunity to move up, there's no thought about it. Well, it was bugging me. Like,
yeah,
this is December. Like, it's middle of the season, pretty much. I think the school was, they were like 2-7.
New Roads?
New Roads was 2-7. And so, you know, prayed about it. And God was like, you know, you can't turn down a promotion.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you have to keep moving forward, even though you enjoy and like it here. And I just thought to myself, and I just sat down, I looked at the calendars, and I mapped out me being able to stay at Campbell Hall and at Coastal JV and still be able to coach, you know, coach there. And I told Campbell Hall they didn't have to pay me.
Oh, wow.
So I would make their practice 2 or 3 times a week, design a practice for the assistant who was there with me. And I think I missed maybe two games. And had a really successful season at New Roads. It ended in a brawl.
Really? This is before I was into the hoops of it. It's like right before we connected.
Yeah, you came right that season, my first season at Campbell Hall. But we were playing against Marcus Levette. Remember Marcus Levette? Over at Providence. And we're kind of just, you know, I have like some kids who just needed attention, you know.
That's a very nice way to say
it. You know, they needed some attention. And once they got the attention from me, like, if my assistant was coaching, like, they wouldn't even listen to him.
Dang.
So it was like they were being let down in some type of way. But the way that they just changed, I feel like it was like a Bad News Bears kind of situation. I remember after a game, a parent literally ran across the court, and there was a bench in front of me. She stepped on a bench and jumped on me. She was like, "Please don't leave us." And it was like,
like a movie.
At this point, it's like I'm not even thinking about it. I'm like, I'm gonna be here full time next year. I'm not gonna be doing both of them. But just to see how much they grew and how much confidence grew in them just made me feel so purposeful.
Yeah.
And we ended up tying for first in league.
Wow.
And we get to the second round of playoffs, and we are down by maybe like 7 points, but we're on a run. We're coming back right now. And we get a steal when my kid goes up for a layup. They hard foul him against the wall. Mm. Next thing I know, that kid starts swinging on my kid. And like I say, they're not saints, man. Both benches clear.
Oh, wow.
And refs call the game. And so since they were up.
I'm about to YouTube
this. I don't know.
Man, that's never good.
Ernest has the film. Ernest was the coach. Matter of fact, I'm going to ask Ernest if he still has that film.
Crazy.
But, yeah, I mean, a successful season other than the way that ended.
Yeah.
And then that was my last year there. I got the head coach job at Campbell Hall.
And that's where we met. We met before that. So me and Thomas are part of the same fraternity, Phi Beta Sigma Fraternity Incorporated. And
I snatched you up, man. That's all you
did. It was crazy. So we were playing each other and playing with each other in the LA frat games and frat league. Mm-hmm. And man, when we were good, and then Thomas came on the team, we were really good. We didn't lose when we played together. It was a fun time. Mm-hmm. Even though he's taller, he was the one throwing me oops. It was a crazy time. And so at the time, I was the junior high coach for the 7th grade B team at Sierra Canyon. That was my first school job. Before that, I worked like Drew Holiday camp and little clinics and stuff. I was just getting into the game. And I went to go, it was War on the Floor at Pierce College. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just going to watch. I hear a good game. It's Campbell Hall versus, I forgot who y'all playing with. Somebody good, though.
We were playing Sierra Canyon.
Oh. Campbell Hall versus Sierra Canyon. That's why I was there. I was watching Sierra Canyon.
You had your Sierra Canyon polo on and everything.
That's right. And so I see T. I'm like, "Yo, what's up?" He's like, "What you doing?" He even say hello. "What you doing? Come coach with me." "Wait, what do you mean?"
Snatch that off right now. That little polo you got on.
Yep. That was it. That was my first varsity job, associate head coach right away at Campbell Hall. And this is before I knew what the Valley basketball scene was like. I had no idea what I was walking into. All I knew is that I'm a hooper. Thomas is my guy, and we gonna do this. And so, Campbell Hall, man, our first year was fun, man. It was fun. It was Aaron Holiday's a sophomore, mm-hmm. Jordan Cohen's a freshman, Khalil Simples, Colin Bell, some dudes on that team, man, that end up doing something with basketball. Yeah. And so.
You had Nick Wrestler.
Nick Wrestler. Ethan.
Ryan. Silverstein.
Yeah. Both for the Atlanta Hawks.
They're in the office for Atlanta Hawks.
Yep. No, I just saw Ryan when we were doing these pro days.
Okay.
Yeah. No, yeah. Me and Ryan, and we saw him in summer league. So, yeah. And he still talks about it. He's like, he used to lock Aaron up because nobody in practice could. Coach Bates. It's like, that was illegal, I guess. I wasn't supposed to be guarding nobody. Hey, somebody had to stop Aaron Holiday.
At that point, we were both practicing.
Right, we had to. But that was a fun time. So your time at Campbell Hall, man, you produced a lot of Division I players, college players all together, and people who became pros. What was that experience like being ingrained in, you know, kind of the heart of basketball? Campbell Hall has a rich history with the Holiday brothers, and you had to, you know, kind of finish that with Aaron and then beyond that. So what was your experience like at Campbell Hall? And
I had a great experience at Campbell Hall. Definitely enjoyed just kind of every moment of that. Was able to, you know, we had a few players, but we really had to work to help the other players kind of catch up to an Aaron Holiday, or I wouldn't say catch up to, but, you know, be of value for basketball, for the basketball team, for us to have any type of success. But being able to, you know, see a kid, sophomore, that's just talented. Mm-hmm. And not just, you know, I always felt like Aaron didn't get, I don't want to say fair shake, but I just felt like people's perception of him wasn't accurate. So just to see a kid like that, and, you know, he inspired those other players. You know, Jordan Cohen, you know, him having to guard Aaron every day in practice, you know, you can't tell me that didn't help him. And, you know, he's doing well playing overseas right now. But just to see the type of work ethic Aaron had, to see the type of attitude he had, he just wanted to win.
Man, that's it.
And I remember one practice, I think it was his 11th grade year. And, you know, Aaron didn't talk much. Didn't. You know, he didn't talk much. And I would remember having a meeting with Aaron one time. I'm like, who do you think should be the leader of the team? And he's like, you know, Aaron's like, I don't know. I'm like, you think it's probably the best player should be the leader? And he was like, yeah. It's funny because he wasn't, you know, he wasn't looking at himself. I mean, I know he knows he was the best player on the team, mm-hmm. but that just wasn't his attitude towards, you know, towards what we're doing, which is great. You know, it makes the other players feel, you know, not feel inferior. You know what I mean? But to see him his junior year start to talk more, and I just remember one practice, I was like, you know, because Aaron will get upset, and then you can't stop him.
Right.
You know, you're getting a knee in the chest and all that. So
they just go off.
I felt like we needed the other players to step up, and the only way that they could step up is to for Aaron to feed them more confidence. And feeding them more confidence is giving them the ball early.
Yeah.
Give them the ball early in the game, and. When they mess up or drop a pass or whatever it is, that don't get on them. Let me get on them.
Yep.
You know, and so there's times where I'd be like, catch the ball, and then I'd be like, that's my fault, coach. Aaron. But I loved it because it helped them gain confidence. Like, he's not mad at me. I missed a shot. He's not mad at me that I missed a pass that I probably should have caught. And so that makes them want to. You know, it makes your teammates want to do better.
Yeah.
You know, it makes them come in the gym and want to get up more shots, because your best player is feeding you nothing but confidence and respect.
Yeah.
And just that one practice, I'm like, Aaron, you can't. I was like, I don't want you to shoot. I said, I want you to do everything. Get to the basket. Get to the front of the rim. But pass it. Find another person. And not everybody You know, some players would take that like, come on, coach. That's literally what he did. Mm. Make his move, he get to the basket, turn out, find an open person. Did it all practice. The next day, I think I'm talking to the assistant coach, and he comes up to me and taps me on the shoulder. He's like, coach, should I shoot today or?
Gotta get buckets.
Should I shoot today or pass? And I was like, and I had forgot all about it. Mm. And I was like, no shooting, pass. He's like, okay, went off and did. And so from that day forward, he just really started getting his teammates involved. And that senior year came, and he was just a real, you know, real leader. And a lot of our, you know, our success came from him, you know, just being a leader.
Yeah.
And trusting in his teammates. I remember one game against Viewpoint, he scores 26 points in the fourth. He was in a little foul trouble, but he was being patient the first three quarters with getting his teammates involved. You know, he's getting double teamed, he's getting whatever. And mm-hmm. Fourth quarter,
26
in what, 8 minutes? Do you know, like, kids scores 26 man. Points. And ask JJ, he remember, he hates that day.
Of course, talk to JJ like that. Absolutely. No, that's, man, and you could see it when he went to UCLA, that team mindset that he had, you know, playing with other stars. But man, I knew from the first day I seen him, he was a pro. There was no doubt in my mind the way he carried himself, the way he played the game. And you would see him play against his brothers and other pros while he was in high school during open runs and just be giving everybody buckets. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, that kid is a pro. Now, after coaching multiple pro-level players, not all in the NBA, but pro-level players, what is it that you instill, do you think, with your system and your coaching, do you instill in them that gets them to that level?
You know, for Aaron, and I would say like a Mike Meadows, who's now at Cal. Mm-hmm. To me, these guys were, Aaron was a scorer. Yeah. There was no doubt, you know, he was a scorer. I don't even think, you know, he didn't even play. He played the two. Until I moved him over to the one. But I knew that these guys are point guards. They're going to be point guards on the next level. So how can I help them see the floor, play the pick and roll? You know, I love the pick and roll. But how I could just help them and what they were going to be doing on the next level rather than playing the two the whole high school and then having to learn how to play the one. Yeah. Once they get past. So I think that when it comes to that, you have to see when a kid has potential to go on to the next level, you as a coach need to think about what are they going to play on the next level that's going to help them be successful. And then we need to start putting them like that in that position now. So I think that's what I always look forward to in coaching kids who have the potential to move on to the next level. I need to put them in position to where, you know, what are they going to play next year?
Yep, and how to make them perform what they're going to do. That's development. That's real development. And letting them play through that. I think that's the biggest opportunity Aaron had is not only because he was, even at his worst, he was still the best player on the court. Mm-hmm. And so he got the opportunity to play through that.
Yes.
And you even allow kids who probably didn't deserve that to play through mistakes, and that's something I learned from you. It's like, man, you breeded confidence into everybody, and made everybody think they deserve to be on the court, which is awesome. And then there's other issues that come with that over time. So, all right, so transition from Campbell Hall, little time off, very little time, right? And then transition over to Milken Community,
very little time off. I was thinking that, you know, I would take a little time off. You know, I had a couple deaths during my time at Campbell Hall, and I never took any time off to kind of grieve. So I'm like, I need to kind of take some time to myself, and that didn't necessarily happen. I still went on a few basketball interviews, and you know, I was starting to, you know, I had found my life partner, and gotten to the stage where I wanted to start having a family and get married and those things like that. So I needed to focus on family more than I was focusing on work. So that was a transition for me. So I needed to go somewhere that if I was gonna coach this next season, I needed to go somewhere where I didn't feel a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
You know, I went on an interview for Milken. And just right away when I walked in there, it's like you just know sometimes, you know. And I just felt really good vibes when I went in there, and I felt wanted. I felt I felt comfortable. You know, I went on that interview and I left there and I was like, I could possibly do this.
Yeah.
And I went on a couple more interviews and I was like, I can't do this. You know. I came back to the Milken situation and I met the kids and you know, I would be with my travel team in a gym like CSUN playing, and parents from Milken would be like, "Are you Coach Blunt? Are you coming to Milken next year?" And I'm like, I haven't necessarily made that decision yet, but how do you know who I am? You know what I mean? Yeah. So I enjoyed the kids. I did like a mock practice with them, and I just enjoyed the respect and the type of kids that they were. Yeah. And at that time, that's what I needed to be. What I needed to be around.
You done pretty well there.
Yeah.
Done pretty well.
Just need to be around a sense of, you know, I love Campbell Hall. I have nothing bad to say about them. But, you know, being in the Jewish community, everything feels just family oriented. And I enjoyed that. You know, I'm thinking about starting a family, and I had just gotten engaged at the time. And just being somewhere taught me that just being somewhere where I can make an impact on kids, it doesn't matter where I am.
Love that.
So I enjoy being there. I know I get refs sometimes that'll ask me, like, what are you still doing over here? I enjoy.
Look at my smile, man. I'm happy, man. You magic with the coaching now. That's it. I'm with the smile, man.
I'm happy, man.
I could definitely see the difference from, you know, that aspect of just pressure. And I think it's because you have support. I think your administration supports you. I think your coworkers support you. Mm-hmm. And the people you surround yourself with support you all the way.
Yes.
And it has nothing to do, and this is not indirectly saying anything about Campbell Hall, I want this to be clear, but it is also understanding that these bigger schools with bigger basketball histories have something with it. There's an expectation that's set upon whoever gets that coaching job that you have to be successful quick, but also successful in the way they want to see it or they've seen it before. And there's nothing wrong with that if that's what the school wants for their coach. But also, your route of being successful at Milken is the impact that you're having on those kids' lives and what you're teaching them about just being consistent in their work. They started working out, actually truly working out when you were there. And they have a rich history for basketball. Coach, before you was there for 30 years, right?
Which was a big plus for me.
Right.
You know, Campbell Hall is 4 to 6 years, but they kind of go towards. And I don't know, just being an athlete and playing in Europe, there was all this moving around.
Mm.
I don't coach college. I don't want to do all this moving around. I would like to sit still, get to know the community that I'm in, and have a place where those kids can always come back and still see me and keep in contact with me and just, you know, kind of be proud of the basketball program that they play for.
Dope, man. That's dope, man. It's kind of come full circle for you, going through some bad experiences with coaches growing up and very unorthodox route to being a pro player and then doing it for so long and then coming back around to coaching. And loving it, man. Loving it. So it's awesome. So we're going to go to the next part of our show. It's called My Rushmore. Okay, we're going to do Mount Rushmore of best defensive players of all time. NBA. Because I don't know if you know some people who could lock up and then, you know, played a lot. So top 4 defensive players of all time.
Okay.
Who you got?
You know, my favorite is Saddell 3. He's just picking pockets, man. I love Saddell. I mean, he guarding you full court, staying in front of you. I'll go with Bruce Bowen.
We forget about Bruce Bowen sometimes.
Forget about Bruce Bowen.
That man can lock up.
Akeem Olajuwon for a center. And I like Scottie Pippen on D, man.
Yeah, got to.
I'll put Scottie Pippen on there for sure.
I think I'm going to – I see yours. You pick specialists. It looks like specialists at their position and what they did. And so when I look at defense, I look at the the intimidation factor that comes with it too. So my first one, GP, the glove, because he'll talk mess about it. And then he'll lock you up, and then he'll get buckets on you too. And I think he's just a balance, with, like a point guard, what the defense is supposed to look like. And his whole brand was built around him being the glove. Like, that's, you know, being able to pick pockets and all that. Yeah. And those shoes was dope. You know, you could zip your shoe up.
Nah, so GP, GP definitely on there.
Scottie Pippen, for sure. I just think, his I think his offense was slept on because his defense was so good. Because he was almost the MVP when Jordan took his year off, man.
Long.
He can guard every position, you know, block, like everything. He gave people fits. Then, this is from me watching them old videos. Bill Russell, man. Bill Russell, grab it out of the air, man. His defense was crazy, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, especially for his time. He was just super dominant.
Especially for his time.
Especially super, super dominant. This last one is tough because there's so many people that I'm thinking of.
It's a little, it's personal.
It is.
Like, my choices were personal. 100%, you know?
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. Who had the impact on me to make me the defender I am, because I'm a hell of a defender. I don't care what anybody says. Can't get buckets on me. And so I'm going to have to go. It's LeBron. It is LeBron.
That's a surprise.
I know, but it's his ability to chase down block. And when he actually puts
You're taking LeBron in. Over Mike?
I'm taking LeBron over Mike.
And Kobe on defense?
Yeah, I am. But you said personal.
It is. I didn't put them on mine.
Yeah, so right. And Mike was the other one. Mike, Kobe. Kobe's was the attitude. I don't know if he played defense. He just had the Mamba mentality. But no, he was awesome on defense. But I think LeBron's ability, his chase down blocks, like he made his I think that's his signature move in my eyes. You know, he has his little dunk, but that's because he jumps high. I think that's his signature move. Mm-hmm. It's going to go get that ball out the glass. And I started doing it because I seen him do it. And, you know, I had bounced back in the day. So can't do that no more.
I saw you dunk another day, man. What are you talking
about?
No,
man, that's an old video, man. Don't look at that. Camera tricks. Thank you, Karina. Like, those camera tricks right there. But, no, I think his ability just overall, man, when he wants to do it. And, that's the argument is who plays defense consistently. But, man, I've seen him change the game with his defense. So I'm going to have to go LeBron. I might have to change this later, but that was a good one, man. That's a good little Rushmore. Yeah. And then for our Where Were You When, okay, moment in basketball history that had a huge impact on you. Where were you and how did it impact you when Magic announced, you know, he had HIV positive?
Oh, man. Magic. I was in eighth grade, and I went to Palms Junior High. We would go up to this donut shop and play arcade games. And one of the kids came up and was like, Magic has HIV. And like, I wanted to fight him. Like, don't play like that. Like, what are you talking about?
Kind of ugly joke.
what type of what? You know, and, you know, not everyone, you know, HIV was like, you know, if I touch you, would you get it? Yeah, it's like, you know, so it was a big statement to make. And I immediately left the donut shop and went home. And I remember sitting there with my dad. My dad had picked me up and us watching on the news. And I cried, and spent. From that past day, Magic's been in my prayers.
Yeah.
So, at Campbell Hall, he was actually on the board at Campbell Hall. So, to come full circle and actually meet Magic, was pretty cool. Yeah. You know, pretty cool. But yeah, that was tough. Basketball was tough for me after that. That's the person that I looked up to. That's the person who helped make basketball a happy place.
Yeah.
So that was tough to see him not be able to continue on and play on that type of level. I feel like we missed out on a few more years of him being able to, be the Magic Man.
Yeah. I think, not to flip, so we talked about this before, and I was too young to remember that, or to, that whole time. Yes, you're older.
You ain't got
to
tell my age.
You're super old. But what I love to see is, we don't know the actual everything, but man, Cookie, his wife, and enduring that, and them still being together, mm-hmm. and building this empire that he's mm-hmm. built from it. Like, we talk about it because it was a moment, but it's not a moment that we look negatively upon, because what he had to do to become HIV positive was being in these streets.
Yeah.
And for her to endure that and to, stand behind her husband mm-hmm. in some real adversity.
Yes.
I think that, today we try to run away from that adversity and that controversy, mm-hmm. especially in relationships, or the divorces or even the disloyalty yeah. in relationships. But she stuck through.
That love is real.
That's real. And it Man. Shows the commitment to a marriage, not to mm-hmm. a person, that marriage stuff. So, no, I think that's thank you for sharing that and your experience with that.
Sure.
And shout out to Cookie, man.
Man, shout out to Cookie.
Yeah.
And what a blessing for her to be able to, not have that.
Right. Yeah. Man,
cause I think
protection.
Maybe she was, might have been pregnant at the time. I'm trying to think of watching the little show that I watched, that the documentary on Magic.
Mm-hmm.
But for her to be able to dodge that
that
bullet, it was. It may have been a little different if
oh, right.
Wait a minute.
Oh, thank God for that.
Thank God for that, right? So the Magic's went on to do some good things, and just him being an advocate, and because we were very, dumb to it, no one really knew what that was about, and there was a huge perception on that, so to come out to the whole world.
Yeah. On Arsenio Hall the next day.
That's
all that.
That's a strong person, man.
Yeah.
Glad he's still here with us.
Yeah. Absolutely. So this is a part of the show where we flip the script. I'm kind of nervous for your questions. Two questions, you can ask me anything in the world. Don't got to do a hoop. Two questions. You are the interviewer now.
All right. The first question, why did you stop coaching basketball?
All right. So it's two reasons. One, I have my daughter, and we all know that basketball coaching takes your day. You're at practice for 2 hours, but you're really there for four because of before practice, after practice, dealing with that. Game days, you're going 3:30 till 9:30, and having my daughter, I knew I needed to be there, not only just to be present in her life and so she can, see her dad, but also my wife and give her the support. And basketball seasons in California are from October to March. I don't care what you say. They're not, it's only 3 months. No. You gotta really prep. And I was wearing multiple hats at Heritage. I was a strength and conditioning coach, the assistant coach, the mentor to the kids. I was doing a lot. And so I had to make that balance. And so having my daughter gave me the perfect excuse, along with as I grew as a basketball coach, knowing that I wanted to be a head coach as well. And I knew that my opportunity could have come. I wanted to do it at Heritage, where Paul's done a great job. He's close to winning his 200th game, has 20 win seasons, and he's at home there. And so I knew I wouldn't get an opportunity there and fully support Paul and everything. but also as I grew as a coach and just seeing different coaching philosophies. It's the same reason with you. It's like, hey, you know, it was a time in my, you know, in my life where it's like, yo, I can't coach anymore. I can't do this. Thomas will tell you the stories, man. I used to ride my bike to Campbell Hall. I didn't have a car. I was living in the valley, working in Baldwin Hills. Yes, I would. No, you couldn't fit my bike in your trunk. That was the issue.
Not a truck. Yes, I could. Every time I offered you a ride, you'd be like, nah. But I took that as like, you know, that's just the type of person you are. You're like, I got it.
I just had to work for that. And but it was just a transition. And, you know, I respect every coach. And I respect Paul. Me and Paul built something special at Heritage. I was there when he started. My philosophy started changing about culture and environment and different things. And I knew if I were there that I'm reflecting that culture and environment that I don't necessarily believe in all the way, you know? And so I had to separate myself from that. And with CORE, the program of CORE getting better and better and growing, I should say. I wanted to say it was better, it was just developing and growing. I wanted to separate myself from high school basketball all the way as well. It was threefold because I was in this position where all these top eighth graders were going to all these different high schools. And I knew that Heritage wasn't a fit for them. And so I couldn't be in that position where I'm like, you know, they want to come to Heritage because I'm a coach there, but I'm not really the head coach. And also, they're actually a better fit over at Campbell Hall. Like, what am I supposed to do? No, I'm going to put the kid in the best position possible. I'm always been about that. And so it was just a multiple things. And so
being able to be neutral.
Being neutral, I'm Switzerland now, and I get to support everybody. I support everybody's high school program. I support Heritage. I support CORE. I can support the kids and their journeys so they don't end up going through experiences that we had to experience, hopefully. I'm coming back to it, though, one day. Kids are getting older. When little Toddy can go be in the gym during practice and, you know, manage himself properly, I'll probably do it. I'm keeping my daughter away from it because I ain't about to be no basketball dad to my daughter, so she need to go play soccer or something.
Man, I don't know if that's gonna work for me.
I know she already hooping.
She's asking to go play basketball.
Your bad.
Yeah, my bad.
It's all good though. Now you get to give her the greatest gift that you have though. You know, besides the love and all that, man. Who else better to teach her than you? So also a blessing. So
what is your motive? What's the big thing that's motivating you? Because you do a lot of stuff for the kids, but what is it that keeps you motivated to keep pushing and developing new areas and new things and new ways to help kids?
I want to see everybody at the best version of themselves. I think it's rooted in my mom's, like she's like that, and so she's always help people who needed help. Like no matter their situation, no matter how much heartache it brought her, she would help people. And so I grew up around that and I saw the benefits, like the blessings that my mom has because of it. And so I hate when people are in bad situations and I just want to help pull them out to my detriment sometimes, but it's something that's, you know, passed down from my mom that God has given me that I want people to, want to see them doing better, but I also have this thing, it's like, I don't want to keep doing the same thing. I don't want to be stuck in the same place. And I think that came from probably living in Kansas and feeling like I was stuck in the mud for a little bit, doing the same thing over and over and getting out of there. And so now I gotta go. Like there's so many opportunities to grab and so many people to help that I just want to keep helping them. I can't stop.
Well, I want to say this. Just your well-roundedness of not just helping kids, but you know, doing a marriage counseling before I got married. Do you know how helpful?
Oh yeah, I know how helpful. Yeah,
you know how helpful that was.
Awesome.
Coming from someone who had been a bachelor for so long and living a certain way to getting close to being married and starting to be like, oh my God, am I? I got to turn myself in 2 months. But just being able to have someone that you trust and that you know has your best interests in mind, and you know, to also marry us at the same time. So you're not just helping kids, man. You like the LeBron James of this stuff, man. You all around.
Thank you for allowing me to be a part of that. Actually, I married him on my birthday. Yeah, dope wedding, beautiful thing. Shout out Hillary. And that's what it is. It's everybody, and that's where the detriment comes from. Helping the kids is what I've been able to put it in my job, right? Mm-hmm. I get to do that, and it's the other people that stretch me, and it makes it I want to say a detriment, but it does. It stretches me, but I want people to be happy, especially when it comes to marriage, man. I think marriage is underrated, and people put all these bad stigmas on what marriage truly is. But when you get to it and you understand that marriage is, first off, is a commitment that you're making to God, not another human, that you're going to try to be one with this person, but it's you constantly working on yourself to know who you are and also accept the person that you're marrying mm-hmm. for who they are. And then coming together and taking everything that you disagree about and just communicating. Like, that's beautiful, man. That's beautiful when you can really break those walls down and
that's a team, man.
Become one. Yeah, that's a true team. It gives you the building blocks to anything you want to do in life, a business partnership, a team that you're coaching. Anything you want to do is rooted in, man, how you love your wife. I applaud and look up to people who stay married, especially through the adversity, especially through the things that were tough, because the commitment level and the things you got to build in yourself to endure marriage, it ain't easy, y'all. I'm not saying marriage is easy, but it is worth it and fun if you have the right mindset.
Yeah, it's not that hard. It really isn't.
It's not hard for me either.
It's not hard for me.
It's not hard. It's work, though. Let me say that. It's work.
I thought it was going to be a lot harder than what it is, but you just got to, you know, you got to listen to yourself and get with somebody, one that, you know, you can still be the being that you are.
Yeah.
And the being that you are can always improve, right? But one thing you can't change is the being of who you are. So mm-hmm. being able to be you is one of the, you know, that's kind of like, for me, I feel like that's like the base.
Welcome to Elevate Your Marriage featuring Todd Wilson and Thomas Blunt. Here for all marriage advice moving forward, which I want to do. Oh, man.
Let us know.
Man, appreciate you coming on the show, my brother.
Of course.
Always a pleasure, man.
Thank you for having me, man. Yes, for
absolutely.
For sure.
We thank you guys for tuning in, and we'll see you next time. Peace.